Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Jason Coy here, 41 years of combination experience, Fire Chief with Laramie County Fire Authority in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Jason has always been around emergency services, so it was natural that as soon as he was able to, he joined the Volunteer Fire Service and hasn't looked back. Jason's route to get to his current position is outside the normal, but it doesn't mean it wasn't the right path. Full transparency, I would encourage the listeners to tune in and listen to Jason's message and mindset. How he views his organization, and most importantly, the people within it, is how we all should conduct business. As the adage goes, there's no I in team. It's about us. It's about those we serve and work with. Jason took this interview to church, preaching the good word on how he views the service. It was truly an honor to listen and pick his brain on various topics within the fire service. If you're a chief or chief officer in a combination department, you might want to grab a notepad and get to writing a few ideas. With that, I present Jason Coy here.
Jason Coy here, Fire Chief, Laramie County Fire Authority. Just a little bit about me. I've been in the fire service roughly over 40 years. I started when I was 14 years old as an explorer, and over those years have served in many roles of the fire service, from volunteer firefighter to volunteer company officer to volunteer fire chief, and now fire chief of a combination fire department here just outside of Cheyenne, Wyoming. I have been a fire chief for the last 23 years, 15 of those here in Cheyenne.
Okay. All right, sir. I appreciate you coming on. So as I always ask the guests to dive right into is, was the fire service always something you wanted to do? Was it a friend or a mentor that guided you in? How did you get into the service?
So emergency services has been a part of my life. My dad was a sheriff's deputy in the summers when I was growing up in the early 70s. His brother was a Minneapolis police officer. I was influenced by emergency services at a young age. George Carlson, an elementary school teacher, started me in an explorer post when I was 14 years old, 13 and a half probably years old, doing EMS for large events outside the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And throughout my life, that's always been a passion. So joined the volunteer fire department when I had the opportunity and worked my way up the ranks. I did serve in private business for a number of years to make money, right? So it gave me a different perspective, being a volunteer and then also working a full-time career job in the private sector. And that's really guided me in my leadership of our organizations over the last 23 years as chief. So, it's been a part of my life.
Okay. All right. With that being said, did you have an individual that kind of guided you into your first department, or did you kind of seek that out on your own?
I sought it out on my own because of that internal fire desire to serve my community and be a part of my community. And let's face it, the adrenaline, right? We like that part of it, but really it was, I wanted to give back to my community that I was volunteering in and or a part of. And a gentleman named Butch Whedon, during a open house of the local fire department, I walked in and he said, "Are you a firefighter already?" And I said, "No." He goes, "Well, you look like one." And he happened to be the state training director for the state of Montana Fire Service. And he really guided me into what I could do in the fire service. And so without him and a bunch of other folks earlier in my life, I probably wouldn't have jumped both feet into the fire service like I did.
Okay. With that being said, that's an excellent topic that I'd like to ask you. How important is it for either, whether you've been in the service or not, but especially if you're coming in new to the fire service, to find that, whether you want to say it's a mentor or not, how important is it for you to find someone that you can at least relate to, ask questions, bounce off ideas from?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's incredibly important. I think as fire service, whether you're volunteer or paid, I think all of us need to be advocates for our communities to partner with us. And if we're on the career side, we should be advocating for young folks to be looking at careers in the fire service or volunteering. And if we're volunteers, we should be advocating for our neighbors to be participating in those communities. The catch is, and I think one of the generational challenges or changes that's occurred over the last 30 years is it used to be you came in and you were told to shut up and do as you're told. And now we want you as an advocate and as a fire service professional, either volunteer or paid, to be the explainer of why. Why is it important to be a part of it? Why is it cool to be a part of our organization? Why is it fun, as we grow our future members?
Okay, I love that. That's how I'm assuming that's how it was for you, because I can tell you that's how it was for me. And I'm not saying it's wrong, but looking at things now, you want new firefighters coming in asking questions, correct?
Yeah, we want inquisitive minds. We want people to understand our traditions, right? Why do we do certain things? And maybe some of those traditions wane over the years as the evolution happens, but that we want them to ask, why do I need to wear my PPE? Why do I need to do this? Why do I need to put the training hours in? And understand the importance of being a part of that team in your organization and truly just getting the big picture. I'm sure for you, you were probably put into a career academy, and you were told, don't say a word, don't ask questions, and you're going to do this, do this, do this. And we did it because we wanted the job. We did it because we wanted to advance. We did it because we wanted to earn our ranks and our stripes. Well, let's face it, there are so many options for people today to do so many different things in the world. If we can't just make them earn their ranks. We still have to make them earn their ranks or provide opportunities for them to earn their ranks. But we also have to treat them like humans and treat them and teach them the whys. Because if we teach them the why, they're going to take our stuff and in 20 years grow it well beyond what one sole person as a leader could do. So.
No, for sure. Okay. So you get on as a volunteer. How long did it take before you decided to yourself, like, I'd love to do this for a career? And then what path did you go to achieve that?
Yeah, so my path is a little different. One of the interesting components is I was in the private sector and I was on a higher spectrum salary, huge bonuses, huge things that financially were at that time in my life important to me. Butch Whedon, who was the state training director, in the evenings would take me as one of his minions. For lack of better words, out to all these fire departments across the state of Montana, volunteer, combination, paid, and we would teach at night and we would do firefighter skills, we would do command skills, all these things. And I would come home laying in bed at 11:30, 12 o'clock at night, just excited and amped up and dreaming about, God darn it, this is awesome. Mind you, I had a great career in private business at that moment. But every night I was more excited to go do the fire stuff. I was more excited to go to the fire department than I was to go to work at that time. So it took a couple of years, and Butch said, I want to hire you. And I said, you can't afford me as a state employee versus a private sector employee. And he goes, well, apply anyhow and we'll work it out if you get accepted. So I applied for a full-time training regional training manager with the state of Montana. And I competed against an FDI retired guy. I competed against a lot of folks that had a lot more experience than I did. And by golly, I got selected. And so now it was that, oh God, what do I do? Right. So I got this, on one hand, I got this very profitable job. And on the other side, I have this very emotionally fulfilling job. And boy, I took the jump. And right, wrong, or indifferent. I went to work for the state of Montana, and that was my first career job in the fire service. I traveled the state. I ran our academies. I taught 2, 3 nights a week in a fire department, and pretty much every Saturday, someplace in the state. They provided me the opportunity to do a lot of stuff and grow my profession. I got to intern at the Phoenix Fire Department for a number of months, living in Station 8 in Phoenix Fire, just to gain experience in the career side of the fire service. So it was a leap of faith, and I've never looked back, wishing I had done it different.
Okay, definitely not a traditional path that most would take. So you just mentioned that to get your experience, you were fortunate and able to go ride with a very busy fire department to gain that experience and knowledge.
Yep, absolutely. So you can imagine in Montana or where you're from in North Carolina, the western part of North Carolina, it's a little slower, right? That's Montana. And My boss, Butch Whedon, at that point says, "Hey, we need to gain your experience and provide opportunities." So we had a very good working relationship with Chief Brunicini and the Phoenix Fire Department, and they opened up their doors at Station 8. They let me perform just like a firefighter in their organization, employed by them, but living in their station. And you know, I ran more calls in that intern process than I would have probably in 5 years in Montana. So it provided me perspective and a growth opportunity to influence my career.
Were you just a backstep, or did they kind of allow you to change positions?
Nope, I got to ride in the back seat. So that was the experience, but at the same time, I was going through their hazmat tech program, their technical rescue program. I was studying all components. I was neck deep in the fire service because I lived and breathed it for those months that I was down there. There was nothing else. I was in Station 8, so I got shift changes, I got cooking lessons, I got workout lessons, I got everything for those months, right?
Okay. And then I'm assuming once you got that experience and the knowledge, you took it back to Montana, and then where did you move forward?
Yep, so continued to work through the fire service training school in Montana, and I taught. I shadowed, I taught, I worked with experts from around the country. Had the fortune of being able to be sent to Europe to study the European system, so I got to work in the Manchester Fire Department to see how they did things. I was really afforded a lot of opportunity to gain exposure, and through that exposure, it built my resume to be able to then transition to a career department or a combination department as their career fire chief. And so after 10 years of working for the Montana Fire Services Training School, I was able to apply here in Cheyenne, Wyoming as a fire chief and was hired full time as a fire chief here.
Okay. If you can, only if you're comfortable, but if you can talk about what was that transition like, going from, like I said, gaining all your knowledge and experience through the US fire department, and then going abroad and learning the European style. And then after you came back, you said you did 10 years and then you became a fire chief.
Yeah.
The transition to become the head person in charge, what was that like? Because that's, I've never been a fire chief, but I can only imagine the undertaking, the responsibilities of what you have to do on a daily basis.
Yeah, so let's talk about the European experience first. So in the early 2000s, I came back from Europe, and in Europe, they were already doing door control, which, as you know, was relatively new in the fire service in the US, probably the last 10 years, right? So when I came back in the early 2000s and said, "God, we got to start shutting doors," and we were literally in training props cutting corners off of doors so we could shut the hose over or shut the door over the hose, and people thought I was crazy, right? I mean, that was way outside of our perspective. So by gaining those perspectives, what it did is it gave me a foundation that allowed me to see that we could be different and grow. So that was an experience in itself. As I grew into the fire chief role, the irony was my experience in private business was managing 150 people and a $12 million budget, all the same skill set that I need for a fire chief on the administrative side, I had from the business side already. So I was just be able to correlate or combine now my fire experience, 10 years of working full time in the fire service as a trainer, with my business experience. It provided me a good solid foundation to transition into that fire chief role.
Okay. So was it that particular department you were eyeing, or were you kind of looking to see what was going on throughout the country?
So I wanted to be in the West. I much like you probably love being in the Southeast. I wanted to be in the West. I love the mountains. I love the outdoors. I love the weather pattern. You might call me crazy as it's 2 degrees outside today. A former volunteer of mine lived in Cheyenne, said, "Hey, the fire department, my neighboring fire department's looking for a fire chief, and he'd be outstanding for them." And so I applied and went through an application and interview process and against five people, and was fortunate enough to get selected. And I'm just going to give you a little facts here. Our organization is 1,200 square miles. where that's how big we are. That's the size of Rhode Island. We do that with currently eight combination volunteer fire stations. So this was a big area, not a lot of population, but a very diverse fire ground. We have a very urban, suburban portion of our organization, which we protect with three fire stations. And then we have a very rural ranch land all the way up to some small mountains. So it provided me an opportunity to be very diverse in our application of the fire service, everything from wildland to urban interface to some urban stuff, vehicle accidents, technical rescue. So it was a really fun opportunity with this organization that it presented itself to me.
Okay. I always kind of liked not only for myself but for the guests too listening, I always like to ask the individual about their department size. So you mentioned 1200 square miles, eight combination companies.
Yep.
What is your complement of apparatus to cover all that?
About 60 apparatus, including some utilitary trailer type of items. Each station has a foundational response of a structure engine, a water tender, and a brush truck. In the urban suburban area surrounding the city of Cheyenne, we add a ladder truck company into that. Three of those stations are staffed 24/7, 365. The other five stations are more of the traditional pager response volunteer, although one of those stations is evolving because of needs of our community that we'll see some more shift work of our volunteers pulling shifts at those stations.
Okay. What's your how did you decide which station is fully manned?
Yeah, so we do that with heat mapping out of data. So data's king, right? In the private industry, they use data all the time. And you think about, I don't know if you're a baseball player or a basketball player or a football player with the NFL going on right now, statistics are incredibly important to those industries, right? Baseball, you think about it, a pitcher gets up on the mound and he's going to be throwing to a batter. He knows the batting percentage of that batter when they hit left-handed or right-handed. He knows the batting percentage if he throws curveball versus fastballs. In the fire service, we have not been great at tracking data to help us analyze that. We've been trying to improve. Law enforcement's done it for years. You watch any law enforcement, police chief, sheriff, whatever, present, they usually have statistics, what the crime rate is of that neighborhood, federal versus federal standards. We use data to identify the needs by using heat mapping of call volume and then judging that over a 5-year period and a 10-year period now to identify what stations were going to become staffed into the future.
Okay. There's a big issue going on with volunteers. So with you being in charge of a combination department, is Wyoming seeing that issue as well, where we just and it's whether it's the times or the economy, whatever the case may be, we just don't have many people wanting to volunteer their time because they have to work, they have to pay the bills, they have to bring food to the table, take care of their children and whatnot. So are you seeing an issue with that?
So the country as a whole is seeing a decline in volunteers. Nobody can argue that. It is not because our citizens don't want to volunteer in any format. If you go to the animal shelter in your local community, if you go to the Kiwanis or you go to Rotary, their numbers are staying relatively consistent. Your local religious venue, you'll see their numbers are staying consistent. The fire services is struggling to connect with people that want to volunteer because, in my opinion, it's leadership. So, our organization last year in a small community, we only have 25,000 citizens that I protect. The city of Cheyenne is roughly 60,000 people. That's my neighbor. We had 40 applications for our volunteer academy last year. Now, we only take 12 on a year. So, our numbers are staying consistent. And the strongest advocates for recruiting volunteers are our members. And so, how we treat people as leaders, how we facilitate their success in our organizations influences them to be advocates for us out in their community. So, when I talk to fire departments around the country that are struggling with recruitment and retention, I say, you got to look inside first. You got to look at how do you treat people? What's your leadership model? Is it, in many cases, a lot of smaller volunteer organizations, it has been a good old boy club, and I hate to use that term, but we got to break that. We got to be all inclusive, and I'm not talking all the frilly federal words for that. I'm saying, hey, just treat people like they're people, and care for them, and provide value to them. And if you do, you'll start a snowball effect of them wanting to participate and wanting to volunteer in your community. So recruitment attention, in my mind, really starts with looking inside at your organization. Why don't people want to volunteer with you? And why can't you keep them there? So that's my aspect. Yep, we're always focused. We're very intentional when we're out in the community, when we're working with our folks to make sure we're advocating to be a member. Right now, we're able to attract enough people to continue to keep us moving forward.
Okay. And if I can ask roughly, what is the call volume for your department?
So we run right around 1,300 calls a year. So not huge, right? But enough to keep us active and enough to keep us going. We run 72% EMS. So the national standard is about 80, 85% EMS. So we're a little bit higher on other to call types, grass fires, vehicle accidents, structure fires. We had three structure fires since the first of the year. So our guys get some business. And with that, like Chief Brunicini used to say, if you want to solve morale issues in your fire station, just have a good call, right? Because that's what they focus on instead of all the other stuff. So we keep them just busy enough that generally we keep from having a lot of morale issues, and excited to be coming to the stations and responding to calls.
Okay. And what's the shift assignment? Do 24
Yeah.
48s?
No. So that's interesting. So as we added full-time staff, that was the first question everybody asked. What shift are we going to do, right? And when we added full-time staff 7, 8, 9 years ago, 4896 was the buzzword, right? That's what everybody was pushing for across the country. I took a little different approach, and it was intentional and it was difficult. But I was looking at the sleep data. I was looking at cancer research. I was looking at all those components that were impacting the wellness of our firefighters. And because my firefighters that we were hiring were local, they weren't living out of district. They weren't living 2 hours away. They were local. I said, we're going to run 4/12s. You're going to work 2 nights, 2 days, and have 4 days off. And the reason why we did that, one, I get to interact with them every day. So I get to see them when they're on shift versus 4896, I could see them one day and then I don't see them again for a week because we're so small. Two, I wanted them to see their family every day, or I wanted to see their significant other every day. If you look at the psychology of 24 and 48 shifts, there's a huge benefit for the individual because they think they have better time off. But the studies are showing that they have to recover a full day. Then they get their work done around the house, and then they have to mentally prepare to go back to work. And when you talk to their significant others, they said, Jimmy or Jane they're destroyed the first day after they come back from their shift. I don't even want to be around them, right? Because they're sleeping, they're tired, they're mentally fatigued, all those pieces. Next day, they're so busy just catching up on their stuff, whether it's their side job or it's their other thing, that I don't get time to spend with them. And then the next day they're getting ready to go back to work, and they're mentally checked out again in our relationship. So we were intentional with it. It's an experiment. We'll see how it goes. But right now they run 4/12s, and that's the system we're using. Our administrative staff, our 40-hour work folks, they work 2 day shifts and then they work 2 swing shifts. So they work 2 7 to 4s. So 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. And then 2 days a week, they come in at 11 o'clock and they work until 8 o'clock. And we did that so that we had continuity with our volunteers that were coming in at night to pull shift, right? So they got interaction with our administrative staff. And that just gave us better continuity at the organization. So we didn't have an us versus them, which happens a lot in combination fire departments. So we took a little different approach, and we've been doing that for 7, 8 years, and it seems to be working all right for us so far.
Okay. And if I'm a volunteer, how do I pick up a shift? What hours can I work?
Yep. So that was the other thing that we studied when we looked at combination fire service that succeeded across the country. We said you get to pick up whatever hours you want. So they ride as the third or fourth seat most of the time. But if they're a driver operator, let's say they've got their pro board ADOP or ADOA, They get carte blanche when they come in on shift that they get to drive if they choose to. So we wanted to make sure that it was a catered system for our volunteers to participate when they're able to participate. We have folks that work for large distribution centers here where they work shift work and they're off Thursday and Friday daytime, and there's significant other works that day. So they'll come in and they'll work 8 hours. They'll work 4 hours, they'll work six. Some of them work 12, some of them work 24 for us based off of what they're available. And then we contour our staffing to augment that when needed.
Is it truly volunteer, or is there some sort of stipend or something to that effect as far as their time?
We have both. So we provide a stipend st system, but only 26% of our members participate in it. They're not doing it for the money. The rest of them say, I'm just doing it because I want to be a part of it. It's fun to come hang out. It's fun to train. It's fun to serve our community. Some of them are like, well, if I'm going to be there, I might as well take the small nominal stipend. But really, they don't do it. We do an incentive program. We had a assistant chief that died from COVID in 2021. And his name was Chuck Scottini. He was a volunteer with us for 25 years, and his dad was an LA County captain. We started a little monetary bonus that we can give out, and they're called Chuck Bucks. You know Monopoly money, right? We made Monopoly money with Chuck's logo or Chuck's picture on it. And we give cash, $5, $10, $20, $50 cash Monopoly money to our officers that then can hand out as a spot award. Hey, great job today. Awesome working. Thanks for coming in. And they give them that little spot award Monopoly money. That Monopoly money then can be spent in our organization department store, which has got t-shirts and hats and, jackets and iPads. And so they can accumulate Chuck Bucks, those little spot awards, and then get a value back out of it for us. So that's been a new program that we started about 3, 4 years ago. That again, just adding value to our members to participate and recognizing people that are doing good work. Our volunteers donated 19,740 hours last year in 2025. 19,000 hours of volunteer from our members. That's amazing, right? So it's fun.
One thing I liked, but I'm also intrigued that I heard you state was the fact, like, if I am a certified aerial or not aerial apparatus driver, you kind of give them the leeway of, all right, like if I come in, I'd like to drive for however long I'm being there, because I look at it as there are, I'm sure, a good amount of organizations that, yes, we have volunteers. All right, excellent. You want to come in and pull a duty crew? We're gonna put you in the back. Like it's the opposite. They look at the career personnel over the volunteers, whereas you kind of do the whole switcheroo there.
Yeah, we were intentional with that. And the primary reason, well, two parts. One, we wanted to make sure the volunteer felt important and valued to the organization. I don't have the finances, I don't have the budget to have all career in all of our stations. Just not feasible. So I'm heavily dependent on the support of our membership. So we wanted to prioritize their ability to participate in our organization. So you go through all the training, you get all the qualifications, you do all this, you do all the things we ask you to do. And then we're going to throw you in the back seat, which is always the funnest place to be, in all honesty. But we throw you in the back seat and you don't get to use all your stuff, right? So we made it a point that if you're qualified, you get to come in and talk to the company officer that day, or what we call them is the team leader that day, and say, hey, I want to drive for the next few hours. I want to practice these things. I want to refresh on drafting. I want to run the calls. Go for it. You got it. And what we found is the guys that are on shift as the driver operator are excited to ride in the back seat for a couple hours again. Because guess what? They get to be on the nozzle. They get to do some stuff that they didn't normally have to do anymore. So it really does work relatively well if our members are forward enough to come in and say, this is what I want to do. Sometimes there's that apprehension, like, well, I don't want to disrupt the crew, so I'll just do whatever they tell me. we want them to say, hey, no, I want to ride front seat. I got my blue card certification. I'm signed off in this position. Let me run front seat today for the next 2 hours. And the front seat officer hops in the back and he'll coach, he'll mentor, he'll be that designated adult to assist that volunteer work in the front seat. So it's fun.
That is awesome. That's awesome. Okay. Now, your members, are they required to be EMT basics, intermediates, paramedics? What's your level there?
Yep, so the very rural areas, we require that they at least have CPR, healthcare provider, and EMR, emergency medical response. In town, at our Battalion 71, which is where the staff stations are, we require them to get their EMT basic. We do have paramedics in our system, so we do have rural medic programs, but and we are advanced life support licensed. But we really focus at the basic level as our normal rule. Non-transport, we have a private transport, a company that runs with us.
Okay. And with how vast your geographical area is, if a structural box comes in, how do you decide which station responds, or do all stations respond?
No, geographical assignment. So we have zones or regions, and that region has an alarm built out for it. And this is one thing that we're enhancing right now. We have automatic aid with numerous agencies that also are on that box alarm or that alarm system. So we divide our district east and west. So on the eastern side of our district, you'd get Engine 71 and Engine 72, 721, and neighboring district engine on that first alarm, plus a command officer. On the west, you'd get a series of different apparatus on that first alarm.
Okay. Do you have one like battalion chief or shift supervisor that covers all eight stations, or is it broken down to?
Currently, we run one 24/7 command officer and then a backup command officer, which we call our OCC. Back when we named it, like Orange County Choppers was the thing. So we just called it our on-call command officer. And that person, both of them have a take-home vehicle. One of them is responsible for fielding those calls and supervising those incidents. The second one's there primarily for the next call that drops, but also if we have a significant event. That OCC is responding to those to be the second set of eyes. Maybe it's safety officer, maybe it's a forward deployed division chief, et cetera. So
Okay. And the stations that are truly volunteer, I'm assuming home response.
yep, mostly currently, yes. Like I said, we have one of those stations that's expanding because of call volume needs that they're pushing to come out and hang out at the station for a little bit. Let's go do some training for 4 hours, and we're going to hang out Tuesday afternoon or Tuesday evening. They're starting to build the culture of, boy, we service the community better if we're here. And because the call volume's going up, there's a higher probability we're actually going to get to respond when we're just hanging out at the station doing stuff. Those facilities aren't built real well yet, so we're in the process of adding bunk rooms to that station, so that way if they want to pull overnight shifts, they can do it.
Okay. And I'm assuming your volunteer members are held to the same standard as your career members. So I'm assuming if it did occur, you have no issues with a volunteer officer establishing command until a higher ranking officer arrives on scene, or if he or she wants to pass it off to that career company coming in.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And that's probably one of the diversifications we're making right now. Currently, the expectation has been that we all get firefighter one, firefighter two, blue card command, et cetera. When we look at the rural area of our community, it's an aging population, much like a lot of volunteer departments around the country. It's an aging population. And the workforce that's available to be volunteers is changing, right? So they might not be able to make firefighter one, but NFPA this last go around, NFPA 1001 created an exterior support firefighter role. So it's everything exterior of a structure fire. So we are in the process right now of developing a spring academy for our volunteers in the very rural area to capture that workforce that's retired, that's at home, that can respond in those rural areas to get them at least NFPA 1001 exterior firefighter. That provides them command working under command that provides them safety, that provides them PPE, that provides flowing water from the exterior, that provides ventilation, that provides all these skills. So it's basic extrication. We feel that in those rural communities that that's going to be extremely important because at least they still are certified, but the cavalry's coming with those folks that have more of those operational interior skill sets. But as evolution changes, we have to do that. We're also focusing right now on some single role responders. We have a bunch of truck drivers out in those rural areas that drove truck for 40 years for the local distribution companies. They don't want to be interior firefighters, but can drive a water tender, et cetera. So we are creating job requirements, JPRs, that meet the NFPA standards for those positions that these people have to meet, but we understand that they are not interior structural firefighters. So again, diversifying our organization to match the workforce that's available for volunteers has been important.
Chief, that me looking and listening to you, I love the track that you're going down because you know as well as I do, there are some organizations out there that they won't take on, oh, you want to be exterior only? Okay, yeah, we don't have a need for you. Or you just want to drive. We need all hazards, all hands in. But I love the fact that you will take anybody that really wants to serve. Okay, like if I was a volunteer and I come up to you and like, Chief, I'd love to volunteer, but man, going interior is just not what I want to do, but I can help do this, do that. That's just to me looking in, I think if areas within this country can what's the word I'm trying to f say, if they can kind of diversify their applicant pool like that, I think a lot of them would be well off instead of, well, we just don't have any volunteers. Well, you do, but you just don't want to look at what they want to bring to you, what they can do for you.
Yeah, that's where we're looking at. Now, I'll tell you that you have to have a balance, right? Because you can't have all exterior
Correct.
firefighters and
Correct.
so making the model work together, it's football season, right? NFL. And we just had the national championship college game on Monday night, and the NFL's this weekend. Not everybody can be the quarterback. Not everybody can be the star running back. We need guards and tackles that are in the trenches doing work. The fire service is the same way. We can't. Now, on the career side, yes, different. But in
Right.
this combination volunteer, especially rural environment where people are hard to come by, we have to diversify those roles to meet the needs of our community and to meet the workforce that's available. I'll tell you, it takes more work. It takes more work on leadership. It takes more work on diversifying that. But we feel that that's going to be our ability to be successful, at least for the next few years, to continue to provide service at a high level to our community.
Yes, sir. No, that's awesome. That's awesome. You mentioned that your organization does blue card, which it's a taboo word in the fire service, like quints and whatever else out there. But if I can ask, why is it that you decided to go that route when it comes to your incident command procedures?
Yeah, and it's taboo and it's not, right? I think they have like 80 or 90,000 certified incident commanders through Blue Card now. We use Blue Card as the foundational baseline for our command structure training, right? So that's the first step. We then build upon it after that. Obviously, I had a connection with Chief Bruneson. He was one of my mentors. I'm looking at a card that I have framed that he wrote to me a couple years ago before he passed. So we were already intimate with the Blue Card system before it became Blue Card. I was actually in a private meeting with Alan in a condo in Big Sky, Montana with 20 other fire chiefs 30 years ago. And he goes, "We need a system like the Wildland Red Card for command officers." And at that time, he was recommending it be called White Card because of the white helmet, right? It ended up being Blue Card. So we were already intimate with the design of that before it became what it is. We use it as a foundational system because I'm a true believer that systems matter. And if we do things consistently the same way, we provide more brain space available for us to adapt to what's evolving in front of us. So let me define that. If you're a quarterback on a football team and you get up to the line of scrimmage and you look at the defense, right? And the defense is playing cover two, but you have a play that doesn't match with cover two very well. In fact, they're probably going to intercept the pass. You call an audible because you studied the defense and you have a system to then call an audible. So you call blue 31 and everybody on the offensive line knows, okay, we just audible to a different play and they know their role. Systems provide you that opportunity. And on the fire ground, we have to look at structure fires. We have to look at the incident in front of us, and we might have a plan going into it, but then we have to audible because the conditions changed. Without a system to audible, status change, priority traffic, which Blue Card provided that, it gives us that system to have the ability to audible on the fire ground, the ability to have good span of control on the fire ground, and on top of it, because everybody knows the same vocabulary, the same plays, the same concepts, it creates less thought process. And I shouldn't say that's not the right word. It creates more memory or space in your brain to adapt what you're doing and think about what the impact's going to be than to focus on the skill. So, Blue Card for us provided that foundational thing. I'll tell you that we certify all our folks in Blue Card to begin with, but then we do a modified Blue Card operationally in our system. We've changed pieces to fit our local needs, but the foundation's the same throughout.
If I can ask, what are those pieces? Only if you want to elaborate, because I'm truly intrigued.
Oh, there's a ton, right? So we actually have a playbook. Just like a football team, a basketball team, we have a playbook of plays that we call out. Offense, fire talk, alpha side, that's part of our Blue Card structure. The engine company knows what their role is, so I don't have to tell them stretch a line to the front door, turn left to a primary search. They know what their assignment is when I just call that play. Second story search, they know exactly what that looks like. They're going to ladder a second story window, whether VEIS, or they're going to do a full search of that to make sure there's no occupants. By having those plays already built in the playbook, rural water supply for us, we have a play called Rural Hitch. And that means that the driver operator, the initial engine's dropping a large diameter supply line and going down that large ranch driveway. Second in apparatus going to hook to that and charge that, supply that engine. By having those plays, everybody on the fire ground knows what they're doing. So those are critical for us. By having the on scene, first on scene engine or command officer give the same exact size up, the same exact format, the same exact way. What it does is you start to anticipate the play before the command officer even does it. You know what's next. And so, again, for you riding in that engine, if you're arriving second on scene, you already know, you can anticipate this is what I'm going to have to do because everybody's doing it the same way. So that's our philosophy.
Okay. And your automatic aid departments, are they also on board as far as communication
Oh,
wise?
I love you. I love you. Those are the real challenges, right? So when we first started that, because whatever, they stood at the fence and said, yeah, we're not doing that, right? 3 years later, their radio traffic started to sound a lot like ours. 10 years later, we actually have a field operations guide for our county that identifies all of those things in it, how you establish command, what it looks like, what it sounds like, what level one staging is, what level two staging is, what on deck looks like. We've defined that. The irony is, we've been doing that 10 years here now. Tuesday night, we had a joint officers meeting with our neighboring fire department where our officers and their officers get together, have dinner, talk about stuff. And I asked them, I said, do you have a common vocabulary for your fire department? And they're like, no. I said, I noticed that. I noticed that depending on what engine it is, what shift it is, they sound distinctly different, right? And I said, we have a common language that we start from day one that certain words mean certain things. There's a difference between evacuate the building and exit the building. Evacuate is dump and run. Exit is bring your shit, get out, right? Shouldn't swear,
No,
sorry.
you're good.
But we have that common vocabulary. So we shared that with them for the probably the second or third time of sharing that vocabulary. They're now adopting it. And what that will do is it'll improve our out-of-way communication with each other so that, again, we can be safer and more efficient and effective with the people that were there because we're not having to think about what do they mean by that. So, yeah.
Well, I ask those questions because it's the same. It's funny how we are completely opposite areas of the country, but my department adopted Blue Card, and when they decided to go that route, we had a lot of individuals that to poke fun, make fun. What is on deck? Like, what kind of terminology is this? What are you guys doing? Blah, blah, blah. And it's funny how, like, we asked for them to play ball and it didn't happen. Like you said, it all depends on who's working, who's riding the seat of that auto wave department. But now it's kind of like the standard in the area. And granted, there still might be individuals, and I want to say individuals, not organizations, but individuals within those organizations that still don't get it, make fun of us, like, you guys are weird for doing that. But me being an officer now, I like the fact that with Blue Card, and especially when I read line of duty deaths, a lot of it always had to deal with officers first on scene never completed that 360. With Blue Card, I have to complete the 360 to finish my transmission. It makes you do that. It gives you that autonomy. I always looked at it as a script. Yes, it's a script, but if you really look at what it's making you do and you go back to reading line of duty deaths, it's trying to prevent you from, if you did that 360, you'd notice there's a basement. You know what I mean? Where when you didn't and you read that article, it's a 360 was never completed. Firefighters went in. Let's just say the first floor gave way down into a basement. They would have known if they did that 360. So that's why I was picking your brain on it.
Yeah, no, you're right on point. If we truly want to be aggressive, right, and which is a big word in the fire service right now, safe versus aggressive, I think I'm probably one of the most aggressive people in my community, right? I don't turn away from a fight. I don't, I've just been that way, right? You challenge me, I'm going to overcome you. That's just my mentality. But I also think we're one of the safest organizations in our region because we build systems that can be highly effective, highly aggressive, but they're also safe. And the decision-making model is a part of that. And so having a system like Blue Card, as long as it's consistent amongst you and your partners, you're all of a sudden can be more aggressive and can be safer. So great work on your department's organization. So.
No, awesome, awesome. Okay. Personal question for you. When it comes to leadership, it's a two-part question. With you being the fire chief of your organization, before you knew you wanted to do this, or since you have held this position, what does leadership look like to you, and what kind of leader did you want to be?
Let me answer that two ways. First off, yeah, I'm a fire chief. I introduce myself as a people chief. What I do is lead people who serve people. I lead our firefighters who serve people, our community. Yep, we do that with really cool stuff, hoses, trucks, all the fun stuff, right? My primary focus as a leader is our people. And when we put our people as our priority, and treat them like people and provide them opportunities to grow, hold them accountable, all those things, they then perform out in the street higher than I ever could have. So my leadership style and what I always wanted to do was be a servant leader to our people. Our organizational chart is actually flipped upside. We have our community on top, we have our members next, then we have our board of or me, then we have our board of directors. Most people's model is that triangle where it's the leadership at top and et cetera. We flip that upside down saying, you guys are more important than me. I'm here because somebody needs to be the administrative person to do that stuff. And more importantly, somebody needs to be guiding us to take care of you and serve you so that you can go serve our community. So servant leadership is my stance, and people focused is my stance and culture. In the private business sector, cash is king. You want to generate cash so that you don't have to have loans and be financially dependent on banking, right? So the more cash you can generate, the better you can be. In community organizations like this, where finances aren't the driving factor, culture becomes king. Your culture is driven by your leadership and having buy-in at all levels of your organization. And if you're not listening, Bruno used to say, you have 2 ears and one mouth. You should be listening more than you are talking. If you're not listening to your people, and not just listening to the words, but listening to the gaps in those words. What are they truly meaning? When they say, "Hey, chief, I'm struggling with this," there's something deeper there. That's just the tip of the iceberg. So as a leader, you have to learn to listen to the depth of what they're actually saying. And then matching our vision with your community needs and your members' needs so that you can be successful. So leadership to me is listening. It's providing vision from that listening, and then it is serving those that you lead.
And would it be safe to say if a leader of any organization doesn't have that mindset? I'm not saying your department can't be successful, but we all know whether you have 3 shifts or 4 shifts, if the communication or standard model isn't consistent, that's the biggest thing. If it's not consistent, you'll have 3 or 4 different fire departments every single day.
Yep, absolutely. And think about this. Think about how your fire department communicates with its shifts or its members. So your career department, you have 3 shifts. How many stations do you have in your organization?
Six.
So you have 6 stations and three. So you have an opportunity to have 18 different fire departments in your fire organization. How does your leadership communicate? Do they send out memos and emails? Do they post paper on the bathroom door stall so you read it? Let's face it, society's changed. If it's not coming through your phone and it's not interactive, you're probably not getting your messaging as a leader. So we do what's called a chief's brief every week. We do a 2 to 3 minute video from one of our division chiefs, battalion chiefs, fire chief every month. And we do it on a rotation. So I have next Monday is my week to do it. The following one's my training chief. The following one's my operations chief. The following one is Battalion 78, the very rural area. The following one is our engineering chief who oversees our fleet. If we have a message, we do a video, we do a text, and we do an email. And so that way are three media formats to get their attention to communicate with them. Then we also do 4 quarterly dinners where we just have everybody in. Just come on in, bring your family, bring your kids. We're having family dinner tonight. We'll have 150 to 200 people at those family dinners. And we just set up and we don't, there's no agenda, there's no nothing. It is just a chance to talk and share and make them feel valued and make them feel part of the family. And I think as leaders and organizations, we have to evolve how we try to connect to our members and our community.
Man, that's fantastic. Okay. With that being said, I'd like to ask you, in your personal opinion, what does the term aggressive mean to you? Because it's a buzzword in the fire service.
It's a buzzword created by social media, right? And
Right.
I did a we did a Fire Rescue One did a survey of aggressive versus safe firefighting, and like 70% of the fire service said they're aggressive and safe. So to aggressive to me is you have to be highly proficient with your skill set. You have to be highly studied and knowledgeable about your enemy, which is in our case structure fires. You have to be highly proficient in deter decision making. That is aggressive. We should be placing, it floors me to think that there are organizations out there that don't place the citizens in front of that. But we do have to balance that decision-making model. We're always going to be looking for the victim. There are opportunities because of the vastness of our organization that, boy, that might not be realistic because it took us 27 minutes to get there because of distance, right? So we have to find, okay, what avenue do we have a chance to be aggressive to get in there? But we are going to be actively aggressive in whatever format. We teach that you can be aggressive from a defensive or exterior position. You can be aggressive. Fast water, quick water, properly placed provides you an opportunity to get inside and be aggressive on those search patterns. So for to me, aggressive really comes down to proficiency, knowledge, training, and attitude and decision making. If you have those functions, you can be safe and aggressive at the same time.
Okay. When it comes to realistic training, I'm not sure what the budget, what your, you know, the your financial budget is for your department, but in order to have your volunteer members kind of, you know, being on the same level field as your career members, what kind of training does your organization do?
Everything's in context. So let me ask you a question. When you went through academy, did you just throw ladders, right? So just right, but did you do it with a helmet, SCBA, and a face piece on?
It was like it's like what we call now the crawl, walk, run
Yeah.
method.
Yep. So we tie that even farther. We start with the crawl, walk, run method, but we tie a series of skills together. So arriving on scene, getting off the apparatus, grabbing the ladder, throwing the ladder, advancing the hose line into a second floor, searching, coming back out. We call that a play. And we have a stopwatch for each segment of that play. So how long does it take you to get off the rig and get your tools? You have 30 seconds to do that. You have 2 minutes to get to the structure and get tips up on the side of the structure. You have 30 seconds to advance that hose line up over. And we have a stopwatch. So we have a tangible grading system for each one of those skills. All those skills are lumped together in that play. We do that for everything that we do, everything from driver operator to firefighter one to extrication to rope rescue. We have a play that is timed, and we utilize that for all of our, whether you're a volunteer or you're a paid firefighter, we have that same standard of performance. So you can't look at somebody and say, yeah, they threw that ladder well, but it took them 12 minutes to do that. They're not proficient at it, right? Then you have your best friend that does it, but he forgets to tie the halyard or he forgets to check for overhead power lines. We have critical failure factors built into that. If they do that, they fail and they have to repeat that play to pass it. We do that with command. We use the tablets and the blue card pre-built scenarios for our command training to keep them proficient at their skills. And again, they get graded on it. So we utilize those systems to maintain proficiency, but also to engage our members. Our members would much rather do that than sit in a classroom and be trained on a PowerPoint or something else.
For sure. Okay. And when it comes to outside training, are you in favor for, granted, there's a plethora of classes that you can take, and I firmly believe it all depends on the individual that comes to you and says, "Hey, Chief, I'd like to go to this." Let's just say it was some sort of advanced extrication, but they really need to have this class to fit their current rank. I'm all about making sure that the classes that the individual wants to go to matches, where they're at. But I'm assuming you are a proponent on allowing your individuals to go outside and bring fresh ideas and new tactics in.
Yep. So we do that strategically, right? So you're right. That it has to be at the level that they're aspiring to be or performing at, right? So I don't want a brand new firefighter going to, whatever, because they just haven't got the skill set there. We also do steer those requests to make sure that culturally they fit our organization too, right? So as you know, there is a lot of training opportunities out there today that aren't vetted, aren't checked, aren't so we do monitor that, but we don't limit it. We're also strong advocates of bringing people here. We build relationships around the country and around the world. This summer we had 13 countries here doing training. We had UL here. We actually literally had a full-size house, a 5,000 square foot house that UL came in and put all their monitoring systems. And we did burns in that house, monitoring with these 13 countries. Well, all of our members got to participate in that. So it's a balance of attending conferences, attending regional training, and then also bringing people to our system to interact with our folks locally here. Yes, absolutely. That's what gave me my strength, right? My boss sent me places. And without gaining that perspective, without getting outside of our small little world, you never know that you're good or bad. And I'll bring it back to sports. If you played high school sports and all you did was scrimmage yourself, never played the neighboring high school, you probably thought you were pretty good at defensive back or quarterback or running back because all you had to do is run against your own team. When you go and play another team, you find out, oh boy, there's some big boys on that side of the line over there that are better than me. Okay. In the fire service, we don't play outside of our local department very often. We might have mutual aid or auto aid coming in, but usually it's not very combined. When you go travel to Europe or you go travel to FDNY, or you go travel to Texas, or you go to South Carolina, or you go to North Carolina, and you go, oh God, I didn't know that. And the aha moment for me was when I was in Europe that in early 2000s, I sat in a Manchester fire station with a crew of 20 people. First off, big department, big station, 20 folks. And from the youngest guy to the most senior guy, they're drawing stuff on the board, structure fires, fires here, where are you making your attack, where's the airflow? And I sat there going, oh God, I don't know any of this. And how come this brand new firefighter in their system and their senior firefighter in this system knew that stuff? And I had never even heard of it. So it's important that we get out of our own house, we go explore, we be humble enough to recognize that they might do it better or different. We have to study out why they do it that way.
Yes, sir. Okay.
You all right, buddy?
No. It's just everything you're saying. It's to me. It's 100%. It's facts, and I just love the energy and how you tie everything together. So it's truly awesome to hear that.
You know, we fail just as much though, but we're not afraid to fail.
Right.
We have to fail to learn, you know, and sometimes we have to give tough love conversations because we did fail and we have to change to learn from it. So that's okay.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you can't, if you're doing everything right every single time, I'm not saying that's not good, but there's definitely always something you can take from a mistake or, something you did on a Friday. I go, man, I really, if you go back and listen to an example, it'd be like your radio traffic. I
Yeah.
sound like that or I said that. Like, you don't know until, like, I call instant replay. Let's say sports. Like for me, the best thing for firefighters, if your department allows it, cameras.
Yeah.
You can learn so much. Like you may think in the moment, oh, I was great. I did a bang up job. And you go back and you're like, ooh, I need to work. I botched that right there. I need to work on that.
I agree, and I think we should be doing that at training. So fire cams on scenes are great, and obviously some liability and legality with that.
Right.
But why aren't we? If you're gonna, if Tiger Woods is gonna work on his swing, right, in golf, they're videoing that, and then they slow-mo. I mean, quarterback moving back in the pocket, they're slow-moing that offensive line, how they launch off the line. They're slow-mo studying that afterwards. Why aren't we doing that in training? Pointing out, hey Jane, you see how you drag the tail of the ladder in here, and that's slowing you down because now you got more friction, and it's, you know, we should be doing that, right?
Right.
We should, if we're professionals, whether volunteer or paid, we should be doing that stuff to make ourselves better. And so you brought up a point that I'm working on, and that is we got to capture our training on video. For one, people like seeing how they perform, like, well, that was pretty cool that I did that. For two, it gives them an opportunity to say, I need to improve on this, and they work on it themselves or they work on it with the improvement plan. My dad got my mom and dad are amazing, but they're educators. They're teachers their whole career, and they're 84 and 85 years old now. Every basketball game, every football game, when I was growing up as a kid, the drive home was my dad telling me, you need to work harder, you need to practice this, you need to do this. And so it ingrained in me that I always need to do it. He would tell me, someplace in this city, there's someone working harder than you right now. Are you going to keep up, or are you going to think you're great? And that was tough. The irony of it is, when I was home for the holidays, my mom and dad gave me this stack of paperwork that they had kept from some athletic events. And there were a bunch of letters in there from coaches, 10th, 11th grade coaches that I never got, that they didn't share with me. And it was, Jason, we see you being, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, they purposely, intentionally kept that stuff from me so I would stay focused and humble and work hard instead of getting a big head. Fire service is the same way. We get big heads because we don't get outside of our neighborhood. We're the best in our community. And if we have a bad event where the house burnt down or somebody died, God bless us, we never say it was our fault. We never say we need to improve. What we say is, ah, that was a bad fire. And we give ourselves a cop out. I don't agree with that. If we burnt a house down to the ground, we did something that wasn't as effective as it needed to be at that moment. Yes, there are variables that control that, but we have to look at it and say, we need to do better. So, anyhow.
No, yes, sir. No, you're preaching. You're preaching. All right. When it comes to wellness and truly being there, the term brotherhood and brothers and sisters in the fire service, there are individuals and organizations that truly mean that. But what does that mean to you?
Yeah, I think it comes back to being people, right? we have to care about our people. That doesn't mean that they're our best friend and we're going out and socializing outside of work or outside of volunteering, but we truly need to take care of them. Wellness, again, let's go back through generational changes, right, wrong, or indifferent. We were intimidated as young kids, right, to follow instructions, and those things don't happen today. So wellness is different, and thankfully we've accepted the fact that it's okay to get help. But organizationally, we have to put systems in place for wellness. You asked about shifts. That was a tough decision for me not to do that, but it was truly focused on the wellness of our people. It had nothing to do with finance. It had nothing to do with anything. It will cost me more because we have to do four shifts, but it was the right thing to do for our people. Even if they didn't want to have that conversation, it was the right thing based off of data. So wellness, we just did a webinar yesterday, if you haven't seen it, on Fire Rescue One, about wellness centers that certain organizations are doing, where they're putting athletic trainers in facilities. They're treating us like pro athletes to get us back on the job, to prevent us from having injuries, all these pieces. We as organizational leaders need to be advocating for that for our people, whether they're volunteer or career. So my mind, wellness starts with leadership. Wellness starts with caring about people. Wellness starts with having a culture of understanding of differences of our folks, that we might not all come from the same religious background. We might not have the same skin colors. We might not have the same, all those pieces, but we have to be accepting of that, and we have to find those common threads, and we need to take care of each other.
And with you being the leader of your organization, are you personally, and only answer if you're comfortable, are you personally okay with going against the grain? Meaning you knew the 4896 or the 2472 or whatever, like it's popular, it's gaining traction. But because of your mindset and your priorities on how you view it, you told yourself, we're going to go this route. And yes, I will 100% take the blame or take the finger pointing or the spotlight, because I'm not trying to cater to the 25%. I'm looking at the entire organization as a whole. And for me, I feel like sometimes leaders lose sight of that. They don't want, whether it's a city council, town council, hell, even your own organization, they don't want to have the finger pointing at them. And so they make a decision that I'm trying to say the
Yeah,
right
they
term.
water it down. They don't
Yes.
want, yeah. They
Yes.
go with the flow instead of upstream, right? I'm not a go with the flow guy. I've never been that way. So my job as a leader of this organization is to challenge the status quo, to challenge us to be better, to challenge us to look at technology, to challenge us to see that. 15 years ago, I took all of our officers and I put them in a room, about 20 people in a room, and I had a big whiteboard on the wall, and I just grabbed a marker and I said, "Tell me what it means to be a firefighter in our organization, or a member in our organization." And they listed a whole bunch of words, right? Honor, integrity, pride, all these things. There was probably 50 words up there. And of those 50 words, there was some common themes. And we just kind of worked it down till we ended up with four words. Service to each other, so respect for each other, that we had to serve each other when we're here, service to our community, and service to our mutual aid partners. Ownership, different word for the fire service. I wanted, and they wanted, them to have ownership in our organization, where we were going, how we were getting there. And so we wanted to instill in our culture ownership, that you own a responsibility to be a part of this organization. You own a responsibility to be trained. You own a responsibility to participate. You own a responsibility to think and create and produce ideas and concepts for us to grow. That's ownership. We wanted unity. We wanted people to be unified in the front. We wanted them to be thinking about how to serve everybody. And then the final one, which is really unique, they wanted to be progressive. They wanted to be on the cutting edge of technology. They wanted the cutting edge of advancements. They wanted to continue to work with you all. They wanted to continue to study, and they wanted to continue to be better because they were progressive and not stuck doing it like we've always done. So that became our values, and we call it SOUP. It's SOUP, and I actually created a Campbell soup can with our logo and the acronym on it. Those values hold true 15 years later. They're still living those values. And because of that, they get to own where our organization's going, which then relieves a little bit of that pressure on me. But I had to be the one to shoulder that and accept the blame. That's my job, to protect them when it fails and to reward them when it succeeds.
Hell yeah. All right. Steve, I always like to ask the guests this last question. Where would you like to see yourself before you decide to hang it all up?
Oh boy, that's a great question. So I started as a young fire chief, right? I took a non-traditional approach to getting there, which has benefited me in all honesty. My year now, I'm the old fire chief, which is interesting, right? So to be a fire chief at 32, everybody would look at me and go, "You look like you're 21," and I'm like, "I'm 32," and they're like, "You're the fire chief, the fire chief, not the battalion chief." And I say, "Yeah." At now 55. Gonna be 56. I'm the old guy in the room. Now I still look it, thanks to my mom's genes. I look young, but those years of service have provided me the opportunity to gain perspective. And what I want to do before the end of my career is to continue to embody and grow the individuals around me that are going to lead this organization into the next decades. And I know that it will look different when I leave here. I accept that. It should look different when I leave here. But I hope that there are some common threads that they continue, which is focusing on people, continuing to be aggressive, continuing to look at technology. I have a core group of folks that have been with me for 14, 15 years here now. And I look at them and I think, God darn it, that's the best part of my job is seeing what you guys do today. I don't do squat compared to what I did 15 years ago. They're doing it every day. So to answer your question, I hope that I can walk away with grace. I hope I can walk away with my head high and have a system in place that regardless of who's leading it, the system still has some foundational values, even though they might do it different, that will last generations to come.
And whenever that day comes, is it you're bowing out for good, or is there a potential for opportunities to go elsewhere?
That's a great question. Nobody knows. I look at again, I think sports, especially college sports, really align with the fire service, right? A college football coach, if they're not producing, generally doesn't last more than 5 or 6 years. A successful football coach is generally only winning national championships in the midst of their career, and they have to know when to leave because there is a right time to leave. Fire chiefs are the same way. Fire chief average life is 6 years in the career industry, partly because retirement's so good now that they can get out and retire. Also because, by golly, they don't stay continually growing with their organization and evolving with their organization. So for me, when I step out, I'll leave the door open for opportunities. I work with Fire Rescue One. I do some consulting with them. I'll probably continue to do that. My wife and I talk about what that looks like. She says, "You're not going to be able to stay at home with me. I will kill you if you're home every day. So you're going to have to find something to do." So we'll see what that looks like. I think that there's a window of opportunity those first few years after to share and mentor other organizations and chiefs. I think that's valuable. But I don't want to be that old guy hanging on, going, everybody's like, he's been out of the fire service for 25 years. What's he doing still, doing stuff? So. Yeah.
No, I love that. Love that. Chief, I have to tell you, just like I said, listening to you talk, the conversation, it's my opinion, and I'm sure others listening, that we need more chief officers, company officers, just in general, we need more firefighters because, in my opinion, just because your title is fire chief, you're still a firefighter at heart. You just have a different responsibility of the organization that you work with and for. But we need more chiefs to have your mindset, especially the fact that you're doing it with a combination department where you realize the value of volunteers, but you're not going the route of, well, they're volunteers, so we're gonna let them slide on this. Nope, the standard is the standard for everybody. I love the fact that you have the mindset of, There's a place for every single person within the fire service, as long as they truly care about bettering themselves and the community. I just love hearing how your thought process is, the way you go about things. I'm sure others find it. For me, I find it refreshing. I find it awesome. That's why I was just like in awe of how you speak, how you have that vision of what you want your organization to look like. We need more of that in the fire service, especially in days now where, you read magazines and articles like, you'll see a fire chief get accused of this, and it's like, man, that is terrible. And so their organization also suffers. We need chiefs to remember that it's not about you. You're not the smartest individual in the room. It's a team collective effort. But also, we need the firefighters to understand that if the chief has that standard, has that mindset, you can't get mad when he or she comes down on you because they're trying to make sure collectively that we're all on the same page. So I just want to say thank you, sir, for coming on. I have thoroughly enjoyed listening to you. It actually like fires me up that you just have that swag about yourself. And I just want to say thank you, sir.
No, it's my honor, and I think the point you're making is we have to be willing to be different. We have to be willing to lead, truly lead. And if you're not, step out of the way and let someone else lead it.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I appreciate you very much. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you.